I've been trying a new thing this week. I've been experimenting with the speech recognition software on my computer so that I can actually, instead of sitting at a keyboard typing, I can actually stand up or walk around and actually talk. And it's pretty amazing, you know? You just talk and your words show up in the document you're working up on the screen. It's really cool. It's not perfect. Every now and then it understands you, and I've noticed that it has the tendency to believe that we live by face, not by faith. And I've also noticed that it never capitalizes the word God, and I'm pretty convinced my computer's heathen because of this, you know. But actually, I'm amazed. I think, this is astounding. My machine, this computer, understands human speech. It's astounding. But I found out late in the week that there's something even more astounding about it. Lori and I have been taking care of Toby and Anna's dogs while they are on vacation. Well, Toby and Anna are on vacation, not while the dogs are on vacation. And so they're at our house. And so one afternoon I was using this speech recognition software, and I was talking, and the dogs were sitting at the door of my office, and all of a sudden, a dog walked by outside, and they started barking like crazy. And words showed up on my screen. The machine was interpreting the dog's barks. Who knew? This machine understands dog speak. I was astounded. You know, I thought, why isn't somebody making a big deal of this? We can communicate with dogs now through the speech recognition. The only problem was it was a little bit hard to understand what they were saying, you know, because bark, 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 bark came out as how, lack, ever, bat. Trying to understand what the dogs were saying to me, you know, what does this mean? Is this some code? How, lack, ever, bat. What does that mean? Well, obviously, the dogs are not spies speaking in some code. Obviously, my machine was completely misunderstanding what was going on and was misinterpreting what was going on totally. And it occurred to me that in a different way, we can do the same thing with God. He can speak and we can completely misinterpret what he's saying. The difference between us and God, in fact, is infinitely greater than the difference between the dogs and us. And so there's a real opportunity there for some misunderstanding. And unfortunately, there are some things that when God communicates ideas, we don't really understand what he's saying. In fact, there are times when God, through his word, uses words that we think we understand, but in fact, we misinterpret, and it happens pretty consistently. I want to refer to a passage of scripture where this reality comes into play. It's one of the most significant passages in all of the Old Testament. It seems like a relatively benign passage, but its meaning is enormous and often understood. Genesis chapter 15, verses 1 through 6. Here's what happens. After this, this were the events in chapter 14 where Abram won a big battle. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, Sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus? Eliezer was one of his servants. And Abram said, You've given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. Then the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir. He took him outside and said, Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. And then he said to him, So shall your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, what happens in this passage, first of all, is that God made a promise. After the incidents in chapter 14, which Abram mounted this dramatic military rescue operation to save his nephew Lot from enslavement, God comes to Abram in this vision, and his first words to Abram in the vision are, "Do not fear." Now, there are some scholars, if you read biblical scholars, that debate, well, why did God say that? Many think, well, Abram maybe was afraid that the guy that he defeated in the previous chapter, Chedorlaomer, the military leader, was not going to take that lying down, that he took a stinging defeat and he was going to seek revenge on Abram. And so Abram is afraid of that, and God's reassuring him. And it seems like maybe that's what he's saying, because then he follows up with the words, "I am your shield, I'll protect you." I believe that's not quite right. There's no evidence that Abram is actually afraid for his life. There's no evidence that he thinks this guy Chedorlaomer is going to come after him. So what is this about? This fact that I think maybe it's something else is becomes even more clear when we realize that the words translated, "I am your shield," actually may not be correctly translated here. The Hebrew word that's translated shield, according to Victor Hamilton, who's a professor at Asbury College and a great Old Testament scholar, actually probably means not shield, but benefactor. There's some question about it, but I think he's right in that. So in other words, God says, "I am your benefactor." And then he goes on and says, not "I am your reward," but literally should say, "Your reward will be great." In other words, God's saying, I'm the one who's going to take care of you. I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to give you a great reward. That's what this is about, not about protection. So why is God saying, "Do not fear"? Well, one of the interesting things that you'll see in the Bible is that there are a number of theophanies, which is occasions when God appears in some form or some vision to people. And it is amazing how often when that happens, the first thing that God has to say to them is, "Do not fear." Later in the book of Genesis, chapter 21, verse 17, when God appears to this woman Hagar in the wilderness, first thing he says is, "Do not be afraid." Later in chapter 26, when Abram does have a son, his son is named Isaac. In chapter 26, verse 24, God appears to him and he says, "Do not be afraid." In the New Testament, you see the same thing. Jesus shows up on the stormy lake in Galilee. His disciples are struggling to cross the lake in the middle of the night in the midst of a storm, and it's pretty scary. And Jesus shows up walking across the top of the water. Matthew 14, 27, what does he say to them? "Take courage, do not be afraid." They were afraid when they saw him walking on the water. That's not normal. In Matthew 28, 10, when the risen Lord confronted the women after his resurrection, first thing he says to them, "Do not be afraid." I expect that if God somehow were to show up to me, some vision or in some form, there would be something about him that would reveal that he's not just some ordinary guy. There'd be something about him that would be so remarkable that it would be awesome. And I'm not talking about awesome in the inflated sense that it's used today, which means really good. You know, you're at a restaurant and you tell your server, you hand the server some cash to pay your bill and say, "Well, you can keep the change from that," and they realize it's going to be a good tip, and they say, "Well, thank you, that's awesome." No, it isn't. It's just good, you know. If you said, and your tip is $1 million, that would be awesome, you know. Oh, jaw-dropping. That's what awesome means. Well, God's going to show up. It's going to be jaw-dropping, but even in the sense of provoking fear, it's just because he is so awesome, it would be overwhelming for us. Pretty sure that if God showed up to me, my reaction would be the most extreme version of "uh-oh" I've ever had in my life. You know, God would say, "Do not fear," and my response would be probably, "Too late, that train already left the station. In fact, I think I need to change my underwear," you know. That's what's going on here. God is saying, you're seeing something that is overwhelming and awesome, and you don't need to fear. In fact, I'm here not to punish you or not to be scary to you, but to reward you, to give you something great. Now, Abram's response to that is kind of interesting and kind of typical of humans. He says, well, that's nice. You've promised to bless me, and you have blessed me, and now you're promising again to bless me, and that's really wonderful, but you're not giving me what I want. How can you say you're blessing me, Lord, when I remain childless? Because I want that more than all of the other stuff that you can give me. And you've been promising, this is now years that God has been promising he's going to have children, and you've promised that, and no kids. You know, the guy who's going to inherit my estate when I die is one of my servants because I don't have any kids. Yeah, that's great. You're going to bless me. But the blessings you're giving aren't the things I care about. What I care about is having kids, and you're not giving me that. My last year of seminary, Lori and I went out to dinner on my birthday. We were not married at this point, and you know, I've sort of thought, you know, you've heard that, you know, beware the Ides of March, the Ides of the 15th. I've thought they should change the Ides of the 13th because my birthday is like the Ides of March. Beware it. It always seems to happen. Something bad seems to happen on my birthday. Well, we went out to dinner on my birthday, and the idea was celebration. But somehow in the course of the evening, we began talking about where we were in our relationship. And both of us knew we really loved each other, but we were at a crossroads in our relationship, and As we talked about that night, we came to the conclusion we don't really have anywhere to go with this. We're going in different directions, and we decided we probably just need to recognize that and put an end to this and go our separate ways. Man, I went home that night heartbroken, you know. Happy birthday to me again, you know. Suppose that night God had somehow showed up to me in a vision and said, Rick, I'm going to bless you with some glorious future ministry, or I'm going to give you great riches and bless your life with all these things. What would my reaction have been? Just like Abraham. Well, that's really great, Lord, but none of that is going to fix the wound in my heart. That's not what I want. What I want is her, and I'm not going to have her. So all that stuff is nice, but it's not what I need. Now, fortunately, God acted in that situation. Lori came to her senses. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. just kidding. Actually, Lord, God worked a really amazing, fun thing there. So here's the deal. You know, Abram's here, and he wants a child. And he and Sarai, they've been promised, and there's no child coming. And poor Abram he's worse off than poor Ralphie, you know, on Christmas Story, the movie, after he got all those presents and none of them was the thing he really wanted, the Red Ryder BB gun. Yeah, how are the presents? Well, they're good, but they're not what I need. God responded, Abram, Eliezer, your servant, he's not going to be your heir. Your son is going to be your heir. I'm going to give you a son. In fact, God says, I'm going to take you out. I want you to go outside, and I want you to look up at the night sky, and I want you to count the stars. And your descendants are going to outnumber those stars. Now, if the Lord did that with me, you know, here, go outside at night, count the stars. Most nights you go out, and, well, there aren't any. It's a brain layer. It's nothing. Even on a clear night, you go outside, well, you might see 50 or 60 here because of all the city lights. In Abram's day, there's no electric light. He's out in the, you know, wilderness or whatever. It's dark. You look up and there's literally thousands of stars. I went on the internet and asked, how many stars can you see? About 2,500. And if it's on the internet, it's got to be true. Otherwise, they couldn't put it on the internet, right? Well, I don't know how many you can see, but, you know, I don't think God expected Abram to go out there and start counting. Okay, how many? Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4. 2,198, 2,199. He would have looked up and he would have said, Lord, there's too many to count. And God would have said, that's exactly right. That's how many descendants you are going to have from your own children. And next comes a crucial moment in the history of the human race. Verse 6 tells us, Abram believed God. He said, okay, that's all I needed to hear, Lord. I'm good. Nothing has changed. Physically, in his physical circumstances, nothing has changed. His wife isn't pregnant. They don't have a son. There's no indication anywhere in their circumstances that there's anything different. But Abram heard that promise, and he said, that's good enough for me. I believe you, Lord. Simple as that. Abram heard what God said and said, okay, I believe it. Now, the response to that is interesting, and that is that God did some what I call divine accounting. God's response to that was God credited it to him as righteousness. He credited it to his account, is literally the Hebrew word. It's an accounting term. He put it down and under his account. That's righteousness in your account. You know what? I once went to our bank, and I had this check, an important check, and I thought, oh, I'm going to deposit it at the ATM, you know, and I checked, put it in there and said deposit, and just after I did that, all of a sudden, the machine just went blank. The screen is blank. The check that I was depositing is now in its greedy little belly, you know, and I have no proof that I had this check and that I deposited it in our account. So I went inside the bank and I said, hey, your machine just ate my check, and it didn't give me a receipt. It didn't even say your account is, you know, now it's that money's in your account. It's nothing. I've got no proof. And they said, yeah, all of our machines just went down. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? And they said, oh, we'll fix it. Yeah, well, what are you going to do? I mean, I have no proof. And they said, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And I said, I am worried. How do I know that you're going to actually say that check is now credited to my account? And they said, we will, just trust us. And that was the best they could do. And I went away frustrated. Now, fortunately, they did. It's important when I put a check in the bank that it gets put into my account. God says, Abram believed God, and I said, okay, in his account, that's righteousness. Interesting. Abram had an account with God, and he's not alone. Every single human being has an account with God. Only in this case, it's not really like a bank account. I would think it's more like, you know, with our bank, we have our home mortgage with them. So we have a home mortgage account, and we're making payments to the bank. And so what essentially, it's kind of like that with Abram. God has said, up, oh, I've accepted your payment. You have righteousness now in your account. Just for believing. That's all he did. That's it. He believed what God said, and God said, good enough. In your account, righteousness. You know, that would be like me going to Wells Fargo, and they say, hey, you know what? We're gonna give you a new car. You're going to give me a new car? Well, that's cool. I believe you're going to do that. And they said, because you believed us, we now have decided that your mortgage is paid in full. That's a great deal. Wow. That's exactly what God did with Abram. God says, I'm going to give you a son. Abram says, okay, I believe that. And God says, then in my eyes, you are now righteous just for believing what I said. That can't be right, can it? It's too easy. Didn't God have to tell him there's something? Now, you got to do something here. You know, you need to be really good to be righteous. You need to be really nice to people and maybe really self-sacrificing, maybe do some really religious stuff. You know, got to go to church, and you better give some money, a lot of money to church, and then you'll be really good, righteous. Yeah. Nope. Didn't do any of that. He said, Abram, I'm going to give you a son. Abram said, I believe it. And God said, you are now 100% righteous in my eyes. Wow. This was hundreds of years before Moses would come along and deliver the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, all of that. God says, here's how you get righteous before me. You believe what I promise. That's it. It can't be right, is it? You're making too much of this, Rick. Romans chapter 4, verse 2 says this. If Abraham was justified by works, in other words, if he was declared righteous, that's what justified means. See that in a minute here. If he was declared righteous by works, in other words, by doing good stuff, then he has something to boast about. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, if Abram worked really hard and was really, really good, then he would be, you know, as good as the best of people, maybe better. And he could boast. Yeah, he's better than other people. But then Paul says an interesting thing. He says, but not before God. You won't have anything to boast about before God. Why? Well, we'll find out later. It's because on his best day, the best things that Abram did, just like for us, on our best day, the best things that we do are failing miserably by God's standards. There's another level up there of true goodness, true righteousness that we don't ever even get close to. Years ago, we used to have a church softball team. And there were several years in which our church softball team was really good. One year, we actually won a couple of championships. And one year, in the area where we actually played in the league up in Oceanside. And Oceanside took all of the teams that won either won championships or finished second in their league, and they put all of those teams in a postseason open tournament. So you could be playing against any team at any level in this tournament. Well, we won our first couple of games in that postseason tournament. And you know what? We were feeling pretty good about ourselves. We won our league, and then we won the first couple of games against teams from other leagues, higher divisions. We were beating them, and we were feeling like, that's right, we're pretty good. We're kind of a big thing, you know. And then our third game was against the Samoan Assembly of God Church. Samoans. Have you seen Samoans? This team was made of all very large human beings, all of whom were ridiculously strong. And I can remember standing out at second base and almost getting a stiff neck from doing this. Wow, another guy's coming up. Oh, another home run. Oh, another home run. Oh, that guy, wow, he only hit one against the fence. They're going to fine him for breaking up the rally, you know. I mean, these guys were just blasting home run after home run. It's really hard to defend a ball when it's hit 50 feet beyond the fence. And it was one after another. The game, they had a mercy rule that ended after four innings. They could have beaten us by 30 runs. We discovered, yeah, we're thinking we're pretty good. There's another level up there that we're not even close to. And that's just in softball. That's the way it is with us. We can think, we look around other people, well, I'm better than that guy, I'm better than that guy, and we can boast about that. But not before God, because God says, you know what? There's another level up there that you don't even know about. And you don't even get close. But God, understanding that, has said, and I'm going to make another way for you to have a relationship with me, to be declared righteous before me. And here's what you need to do. It's one thing you can actually do. You believe my promise. That's it. Our accounting kind of goes like this. I'll put it in school terms. Our accounting system sort of is like this. How many answers did you get right on the test? 95%. Wow, that's really good. You get an A. How many answers did you get right on the test? 65%. Well, that's not so good, you know, but you passed. How many answers did you get right? 53%. It's bad. You failed. And that's how we think the accounting goes. And that's what we think God is doing. Here's the test. How many did you get right? How many did you get wrong? That's not how God accounts. Because for us, when it comes to passing the test, it's going to come down to this. How many answers did you get right? Zero. We don't get one right. Because our righteousness on our best day is not righteousness truly. But God uses a different grading system, a different accounting system. And he says, here's what I need for you to do. Believe me. And if you will believe me, then you are righteous. I give you a promise. Do you believe it? Wow, that's it, huh? That's what this passage tells us. Let's think about some implications. The first one is this. Who cares about righteousness? You know, this is where our misunderstanding shows up. We read righteousness and we literally turn that into how, lack ever bat. We're getting the wrong thing, you know. The average person in our society says, what is with you religious people and your fascination with righteousness? We don't care about righteousness. You know, in fact, I think it's a bad thing. You people think you're so righteous because you keep all your little rules. And frankly, you then look down on other people who don't keep your little rules. And I think that's worse than breaking your dumb little rules. And I got to tell you that your being so righteous, frankly, makes you about as fun as an IRS audit. So you can have your righteousness. I don't want any part of it. That's kind of our world's view of it. Our secular friend totally misunderstands righteousness. And the sad part is that most Christians, in a different way, misunderstand it also. We interpret it to be something it is not at all. The truth is that our secular friend who thinks righteousness is something he has no interest in whatsoever, in fact, that guy and every other human being on the planet is desperate for righteousness. We long for righteousness more than almost anything else in life. We need it as badly as our bodies need air. The Hebrew term that's translated righteousness here literally came from a root that meant to be straight. And you could almost translate it rightness. To be straight, we used it, it's the term that could be translated justified or justification. If you're using a word processor, it says, well, you can have your text be left justified, mean lined up straight along the left side. To have righteousness means you are lined up correctly and you're straight there. In other words, it means to be declared right, to be approved. That's really what it means. That when you have righteousness, you have been given the stamp of approval and say, this person is good, this person is all right, this person is okay, this person is accepted. That's what righteousness is all about. If you watch a cop show on television, there's a cop that is in a tense situation where a person has a gun and comes at and he's a threat to the officer and to other people. And in self-defense, the officer has to shoot him and is investigated. And then they say, oh, it was a righteous shooting, meaning it was declared to be right and good and justified. Same idea. So, the problem for us is that we religious people typically think of righteousness as, oh, that's keeping all the rules, doing all the things, and then passing the test, and that makes you justified. Here's the thing. Every human being desperately longs to be approved, which means we long for righteousness. We are desperate to be justified. Are you weary of Deflategate? Some of you don't even know what that is. It's the big brouhaha, or the stupid brouhaha, over the fact that back in January in a playoff game, the New England Patriots deflated some footballs so they were easier to grip in the cold weather and broke the rules in so doing. And so there has been this huge thing that has blown up over this, and now it's in federal court between Tom Brady, the Patriots quarterback, and the NFL. And the poor federal judge who's dealing with the case is annoyed. He's saying, why is this even in my court? Settle it and go away. It's a dumb thing. It has been badly mishandled. Millions, probably $10 million in legal fees now over this stupid little thing. Here's the question. Why is that happening? Particularly, think in terms, we'll just look at one side of it, the equation. Why is Tom Brady suing the NFL over this thing? Now, you might say, oh, it's because they want to suspend him for 4 games. He's fighting that. You know what? It's not about the 4 games. He could have, if he had just said, yeah, you're right, I wanted him to do that and I was involved in that, they would have said, okay, then we'll just forget the suspension or put it down to 1 game. He's not doing that. What is he upset about? He's upset about being justified. This is a guy, Tom Brady, as a quarterback, has taken his team to 6 Super Bowls. No one else has ever done that. He has won 4 Super Bowls, which ties him for the most ever won by a quarterback. He's handsome. He's married to Gisela Bündchen, a supermodel. Do you know how much money Gisela Bündchen made as a model last year? $47 million. Yeah, she's at the top of her game. Do you know how much money Tom Brady and his wife together are worth, what their net worth is? $410 million. He's wealthy, he's handsome, he's married to a beautiful woman, and he is a stone-cold lock to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Why does he care what people say? Because we human beings can't stand to think that somebody thinks there's something wrong with us. And I'll take you to court to stop it, if necessary. We are desperate for justification. Yeah, but that has nothing to do with this passage. You're talking about righteousness. Yeah, it has everything to do with it. This need for justification, it's everywhere in the world and it's everywhere in our lives. In their book, Mistakes Were Made, Carol Aronson and Elliot Tavris expose the prevalence of our need for justification. They say it's everywhere and it's dangerous. They wrote, all of us, to preserve our belief that we are smart, will occasionally do dumb things. We can't help it. We're wired that way. Our efforts at self-justification are all designed to serve our need to feel good about what we have done, what we believe, and who we are. We're wired for justification. It means we are wired for righteousness. These are not Christian people. They're sociologists. They're looking at the human race and they're saying they're wired for righteousness so much that it controls them. Lori and I had one of those little weird interactions that married couples occasionally have. I don't even remember what we were talking about. I don't remember exactly what she said, but she said something about going up in a context where what she should have said was going down. And I said, oh, you mean go down? She said, what? I said, you said go up and you meant go down. And she said, I didn't say go up. I said, yes, you did. I just heard you. And she said, no, I didn't, Rick. What's wrong with your hearing? You know what? We had this little, she was irritated with me. I was irritated with her. Well, what was that about? I have to prove that I'm right and you were wrong. And so I'm justified. And that thing, that little thing, it crops up in all these little places all over the world, in all of our lives, and it never goes away. Why? It never goes away because we keep trying to justify ourselves, gain righteousness, gain approval in the eyes of other people, and they can never give us the approval that we're seeking. Because what we long for, and most of the time are not even aware, is what we're seeking is this ultimate court that will declare us good and approved. We're seeking righteousness before God. People can never give us that. And that's why it's always there. Lori and I went for a walk. Part of the way through our walk, I noticed some discomfort in one of my feet. I could feel something in my shoe. And the rest of the walk, man, that thing annoyed me. Finally got home and took my shoe off, and it was this just tiny little pebble. It was just tiny thing, but man, that was irritating. And I thought, this thing about righteousness, it's the pebble in our shoe. It never goes away. We can feel it all the time, and it crops up in all these places. And any time if you have ever been falsely accused or misunderstood, bam, it's there, and it's just like, I can't let go of that. And at the end of the day, what it's all about is righteousness before God. So who cares about righteousness? Every single human being, and we care about it almost more than we care about anything else. So here's the question. How do we get it? How do you get righteousness? Well, there's a nearly irresistible approach that you'll find in every human being. We believe with all of our hearts that we earn it. We have to do something to gain it. We have to prove it somehow. You know, for me to get the USDA stamp of approval, grade A, it has to meet some standard. And we get that, and we think that because it's everywhere in life. If I can just meet that standard, whatever it is, then I will be approved. Then I'll have righteousness. When Jay Leno was still doing his late night television show, he used to occasionally go out on the street and ask people questions at random. One night, this was kind of interesting, he went out and he asked people, stopped them, and he said, name one of the Ten Commandments. Do you know what the most common response was? It was this: God helps those who help themselves. What? Is that a commandment? That's what people came up with more than anything else. And people really believed that. In other words, if you want to be declared righteous, how do you get that? Well, you got to start by helping yourself. You got to do it yourself. That message actually goes all the way back to Aesop and some of the other Greeks, but it was formulated in those words by a man named Algernon Sidney in the 17th century, picked up by Benjamin Franklin and put into his Poor Richard's Almanac. God helps those who help themselves. And that idea is everywhere in the world. The Quran has a passage that says, indeed, Allah will not change the condition of people until they change what is in themselves. You got to fix yourself. It's up to you to become righteous. Do it yourself. Here's the problem with that. That is turning God's righteousness message into how, lack, ever, bat. You're missing it completely. It runs head on into biblical theology. God is holy, meaning he's perfectly good. And if we're going to meet that standard, then we have to be perfectly good. Meaning, we have to never even have a thought that isn't anything but 100% good. How many of us meet that standard? That'd be about zero. We never have. We don't today. We never will. We won't get close. Romans 3:20 says, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by works of the law. In other words, by doing it, working harder at it. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. All of the law does for us is show us how far we fall short. That's one of the big problems with this. And the effect of that is devastating. Kevin Costner, the actor, co-starred in the movie The Bodyguard with the late singer and actress Whitney Houston. And she was, of course, an enormously talented woman, terrific singer. But as the filming of that movie started, she was a basket case because she was just afraid that she couldn't do it. She was plagued by doubts in the sense that she wasn't good enough. Costner, after her death, said this: "The Whitney that I knew, despite her success and worldwide fame, still wondered, am I good enough? Am I pretty enough? Will they like me? It was the burden that made her great and the part that caused her to stumble in the end." You know, that burden of needing to be judged, approved, righteousness drove her to be really good, but it destroyed her. She could not live with that burden. None of us can. And when we go running through life thinking, this is how I'm going to get there, I'm going to earn it, it's going to destroy us, all of us. We can't live with it because we can never measure up. God is very much aware of our problem. And so he had another plan for us to be declared righteous. In Romans 4, verses 23 and 24, it says, "The words it was credited to him were not written for Abram alone, but also for us, to whom God will credit righteousness, for us who believe in him who raised Jesus our Lord from the dead." Philippians 3:9, Paul said that what mattered is to be found in Christ, not having a righteousness that of my own that comes from the law, in other words, not earning it, but that which is through faith, through believing in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. God says, "Trust me, believe me, and I will credit it to you as righteousness, the righteousness that you all seek desperately. Simply believe." Seems too easy, doesn't it? Leaves us with a number of questions. Why is believing, why is faith so important? How can that be fair? How can that produce a good result? You know what? I'm not going to answer those questions this morning, but we're going to address them in a few weeks. So keep coming back and you'll get the answer to those. For now, understand this principle, for it is at the heart of the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So what do? Well, we believe God. What God supplies is enough. That's a crucial truth in all of life. Believe that in every aspect of life. What God has provided us with Jesus Christ is enough that if we will trust in him, we are righteous in his sight. Believe God. Secondly, rest. Our biggest problem is we don't believe it's that simple, and we keep trying to go back and earn righteousness before God by doing something. Here's a truth that we need to know, that we're like someone whose mortgage has been fully paid, who keeps going back to the bank trying to make payments. It's done. It's done. Forget about it. Relax. Rest. When we fail to believe and we start trying to earn justification before God, we put into effect a whole host of negative dynamics that lead to doubt and tension and rationalization and fear and exhaustion and a total lack of peace. We drive ourselves to exhaustion and all manner of hypocrisy because we're trying to get approval that has already been given to us. So rest in what you have been given. When you feel that constant pull to justify yourself, to prove that you're right, to prove that you're good and that you're approved, see it for what it is and don't give in to it. Say, you know what? That is done. I'm finished with that. I'm righteous because I trust in the promise of God and for that reason alone. And so finally then, rejoice. This is great news. We're free. At last, we can rejoice knowing we're righteous. Whatever anybody else thinks, whatever anybody else says, whatever our own consciences sometimes say to us, it's okay because we are righteous by trusting in God's promise. And that brings real peace. Let's pray. Father, Wow, what great news. We recognize, as we've been just thinking about this morning, that we all are desperate for righteousness. We don't think that, but as we think about it, we begin to see how it crops up in our lives all over the place in a lot of different ways, all that go back to the same root, that same pebble in our shoe, that what we really need is to know that you have said, this person is righteous in my eyes and accepted and approved and loved. Father, help each one of us here this morning to come to the realization that we're not going to earn that, no matter how hard we try, because we always fall short, and we'll hear more about that in a few weeks. And in the meantime, Lord, help us then to do what Abram did, to believe your promise, to just accept it, and to be declared righteous through your grace. Amen.